You are listening to The Pilgrim on the 405 with Will Crist. Join him as he and his guests discover how businesses thrive in California.
Welcome to The Pilgrim on the 405. We have an exciting program today. We're going to be talking about how not only how businesses thrive, but how businesses soar in California. Joel Lindenberg is a very competent career investment banker. We could talk about facilitating over $500 million in middle market M&A and capital formation transactions. That's all wonderful and good. But what we really want to know is, what are you seeing out there in the business world right now that will help businesses thrive in California? And we're also going to be talking about one of the most innovative and creative programs, Singularity University. So, Joel, welcome to The Pilgrim on the 405.
Thanks, Will. Glad to be here.
So tell us a little bit about what you're seeing in the business marketplace right now in terms of middle companies, M&A, capital formation.
Well, I think if you're looking to raise capital or, you know, possibly acquire a business, there couldn't be a better time to do it. I mean, there's just sort of a perfect storm of factors that have created an ideal environment for these types of transactions. Obviously, private equity has raised over $3 trillion in the past 5 years, so more dry powder available to be deployed than really ever before. We're also seeing a significant uptick in activity due to the recent tax cuts. Lots of companies have more cash to play with, particularly in the middle market. So there was actually a great New York Times article this morning. About half of surveyed executives said they were going to increase or accelerate their M&A schedules over the course of the next year. And another 75%, let me look at the stat quickly. Another 75% of respondents intend to use their tax savings on acquisitions. So really a frothy environment. Multiples are higher than they've ever been. I think over half of deals went for over 11 times EBITDA last year, which is historically significant and really outstanding. So great time to access capital markets and or sell a business.
And now, just curious, has the repatriation of large capital funds that have been in offshore for a long time, is that playing any part in this?
I think it is. I don't know if it's necessarily what we'd call a driver in terms of being a factor, but it definitely is a factor. I mean, anytime companies have more liquidity, more cash at their disposal, M&A becomes much more attractive.
So for the mid-sized business owner, what does that mean? Does that mean you should be out looking to acquire, or should you be out looking to be acquired?
It's really a seller's market right now. So if you're considering the sale of a company, this is a good time to do it. If you're looking to buy companies, valuations are going to be much higher. So you're going to pay more for those assets, and the process is going to be more competitive. As I mentioned previously, lots of private equity in the market right now as opposed to just strategics. So some of these deals are getting bid up quite seriously. So it's a better time to be a seller. If you're, kind of a lower middle market player, you're probably looking to sell rather than buy at this point. But either one can be profitable at any time given the right circumstances.
So who's buying, who's pushing up those multiples? Is it the strategic buyer or is it the capital equity?
It's a combination of the two. Certainly both have more liquidity, more dry powder at their disposal than they've had in a long time. So for those reasons, they're both competing in these markets and conspiring really to drive these multiples higher and higher.
Conspiring. I'm sure that wouldn't be something they would be thinking about, right? This is not a fundable conspiracy.
Certainly
here.
Not. No, these people want to keep prices low. So if they were conspiring to do anything, they'd be trying to drive prices down. But what we're seeing is a mechanism of this liquidity is prices right. Going up. So yeah.
All right. So what companies are in play right now?
I mean, we're seeing a lot of activity, especially in healthcare services.
Oh,
I think retail healthcare is about as hot as any sector is right now. My specialty is, in fact, more on the technology side. So that's digital media, cybersecurity, and then cloud and SaaS solutions. So that's where I do a lot of research on my own. And, obviously that space continues to be a driving factor in terms of, you know, what markets are hottest. We're seeing cybersecurity deals go for multiples that are, you know, really unheard of in other aspects or other sectors of the M&A marketplace. So that's a huge one. But digital media, a very fragmented market, a lot of ad tech companies out there that are looking to be acquired or could be acquired as part of a roll-up strategy. So I'd say looking at, you know, personally, my view is, you know, digital media, technology, ad technology, those are really hot spaces right now.
So tell me what role you play.
So a couple different roles, and it kind of depends where you're at in your process. I can do a lot in terms of preparing and planning for a transaction. So that's front-end accounting, making sure your books are in order, really getting the technical accounting and financial reporting aspects out of the way before you actually go to market. And then for a company who's a little bit further down the road, they've thought through this, they've been thinking about a transaction over the course of the past, say, 6 months to a year, and they're ready to kind of test the waters in terms of capital markets. You know, at that point, we can come in and really facilitate a process whereby we bring different strategic and financial buyers or bidders to the table and, you know, create an auction style environment where we drive the valuation of your company as high as possible.
Well, all right. So what should a company be thinking about before they call you?
I think most importantly is to really have the financial health of the company in order, right? And there's a lot you can do in terms of just systems and methodologies to prepare the company. A lot of people don't realize the extent of the due diligence they're going to be subjected to in one of these processes. So what I always say is, you know, you want to be planning on a little bit longer term horizon from when you actually want to effect a sale. You probably want to be thinking about this, you know, 2 to 5 years ahead of a sale, ideally. But if you don't have that much time, you know, 18 months at least, just to get your books in order, get the financials right, you want to make sure that quality of earnings comes back exactly how you think it will. You know, these are key things that can really sort of either drive a process or hurt it, you know, during the course of diligence. So these are things you really want to have in order, especially the accounting and the financial reporting.
When in working with companies with the entrepreneurial operating system, with EOS,
mm-hmm. Sure.
You know, we tell them that EBITDA is certainly an important part of a sale, but it may not be the only part. That a couple of other things we know fall into place. One is, what's the quality of the relationship with your people?
Yeah, absolutely.
Because ultimately, Mr. Business Owner, you're going to be moving out of this place, and the buyer wants to know. Unless he's just buying it to crush it and to eliminate the competition. But the buyer wants to know, do these people get it? Do they want to be here? Are they capable of doing it? Do you have the right people in the right place? Are they long-term people, or are they going to be leaving when they hear that the sale's been consummated?
Yeah, absolutely. I think you just hit on what's a critical factor in any acquisition, and that's the talent integration at the end of the deal. I mean, a lot of people think, you know, we got this deal done, we're good to go. That's certainly not the case. About 50% of deals, in fact, fail to realize any significant return on investment for the acquirers because the integration doesn't go as they planned. So talent planning, talent integration, a critical factor in success in any M&A deal, especially in the technology space where we're seeing, you know, unemployment 4.1%, incredibly competitive markets for engineers, software developers. I mean, these people are very difficult to get. Oftentimes, companies are being acquired just to get the talent. So sometimes it's an IP play, as you've traditionally seen in a lot of tech deals. But a lot of times, people want those engineers. They want that talent on board, and they're willing to pay a premium for that. So talent is a bigger piece of the equation probably than it's ever been in the past.
And talent means having the right, not just having star talent, because we know what happens. We saw what happened with the Lakers, just having star talent.
Sure,
that's not
sure.
enough. You've got to have a team. You got to have a team that's working together effectively to accomplish the vision, and that means that they can move effectively to accomplish the next vision, and learning that help, because we know, unfortunately, most leaders don't work well on a team, right? And so how that leadership team works, so goes the rest of the company. And so when you get that leadership team working together consistently, rowing all in the same direction, supporting each other, solving problems, that becomes a very valuable commodity.
Oh, absolutely. I couldn't agree more. And, you know, we touched on this in a recent CFO roundtable discussion I had hosted about the need to hire people who are flexible and can adapt to different situations. Our guest put it in terms of hiring athletes as opposed to resumes or credentials. They want people who have an intellectual curiosity and can excel in a number of different roles. And those are the people that are really going to drive your company forward, you know, through not only an acquisition, but also the integration. They can take on additional roles. They're willing to learn new skills, step in and really add value in places that maybe you didn't originally hire them to do so. Those are the people you need in those positions. And it's, I think it speaks, you know, exactly to your point.
They've got to be team players.
No question.
And they have to know how to be team players in this particular place. So EBITDA is important, getting the right people in the right place. And then the third thing that we believe drives value is, do we have the processes all written down?
Sure.
I mean, every company has its unique way of hiring, unique way of doing their finances, a unique way of selling, customer service, and certainly unique ways of creating the IP or the product or the service. But is that written down? We're not talking about ISO kind of written down,
right?
Massive. We're talking about for each process, one or two pages at the most. But when we can put that into a three-ring binder and say, "You got the check, we got the process."
Right. No, I can agree more. I mean, memorializing that institutional knowledge is invaluable, really, especially for an acquiring company. If people know how to do things, but they can't translate to letting other people know how to do those things, that's a massive, massive failure in terms of integrating those companies. So that's, I just can't stress the importance of that enough. I think you're exactly right.
And now, in your experience, how many companies come to you with this kind of, with 80, 90% strong in each of the six competencies of vision, people, data, issues, processes, and traction, knowing how to run the company? How many companies come ready with all of that?
Surprisingly few. I mean, you know, you get lucky on the off chance that somebody's strong in all those categories, and obviously that's great. It makes my job that much easier. But oftentimes what we find is, you know, there's one or more of those, categories where there is some lack and it could use some improvement. And look, every business can always improve everywhere, right? But when you're talking about 90% threshold, I'd say it's very, very few. And a lot of what we do on the front end is trying to make sure that those things are in place and that those people are prepared to maximize their value in the marketplace.
Our research across the nation with companies, most companies are operating at 20%. They're succeeding in spite of themselves.
Right.
And the attempt then is to jack up that EBITDA so that, hopefully we can get a higher. But the reality is, if you got 3 to 5 years, you can turn that company into a place where 70-80% strong in every one of those six, right?
Oh, absolutely. And that's why I would say, I mean, preparation is everything in this business. You know, the further out you can start preparing for these types of transactions, the better it's going to go. I mean, if you're raising capital or something like that, you know, that can be done over a, you know, fairly shortened time horizon. But if you're actually looking to, you know, sell a business, exit a company, you really want to be planning on a 3 to 5 year sort of timeline.
Well, all right. And planning means strengthening that business to make it the best it can possibly be.
Absolutely. I mean, it takes time to do these things. It takes time to turn a ship around. And even if you don't have to turn it around or you just have to steer a little bit differently,
right?
It does take time. And the more time you can invest, it's just like anything else, the better your outcome is going to be on the other end.
Because even though there's a lot of dry powder out there, a lot of money that's floating around available to acquire, that doesn't mean people are less due diligent.
No, in fact, they're likely more diligent. And they're paying higher prices. The process is taking a little bit longer. They want to make sure that they're getting value for those investment dollars. So I'd say there's been no drop off in diligence. I'd say, if anything, you know, people are more, they're just more careful in terms of how they're investing those dollars because they're paying higher prices for those assets.
And they're looking for high quality business, not just high quality IP, not just this flash in the pan. Well, we'll push up our revenue for the last couple of years to hopefully get a higher EBITDA and a higher multiple, right?
Right.
So,
absolutely.
So the real strength of the company is in those six key components. And that's specifically what we've been talking about in the past couple of weeks here with some EOS implementers, because it's getting in and spending that, 2 years really helping that company get the systems down so they know what they're doing. They're following, getting that data every week. They're spending that 90-minute meeting every week looking at their progress, and then also solving problems.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what's the old adage? If you can't measure it, you can't fix it, you can't improve it. So I think having those measurements and those metrics and those KPIs in place, you know, goes so far towards improving the fundamental value of a business, right? You can understand exactly what's been happening over, you know, a longer term or longer time period. You can understand, you know, where you can make improvements and really derive more value from the business at the end of the day.
Well, wonderful. So can you stick around? We're gonna take a little break here and hear from our sponsors, but I want to talk to you about your experience with Singularity University.
Yeah, absolutely. Happy to do so.
Well, we'll take a little short break here from the Pilgrim on the 405, where we've been talking about how to make businesses thrive, in particular, how to prepare businesses for to be acquired.
Hi, it's time for another tip from Sandler Training. Never ask for the order. Make the prospect give up. Always ask for the order is the salesperson's 11th commandment. You know, the one that just dropped right off the tablets. Never ask for the order goes completely against traditional selling methods. If you don't ask for the order, how will you ever know when the customer is going to buy? Well, think about it. The only person who can really ask for the order is the prospect. Find the prospect's emotional needs first, provide the answers to meet these needs, and you'll discover that the prospect will give up and ask you for the order. And that's another tip from Sandler Training, finding power through reinforcement.
Well, welcome back to the Pilgrim on the 405, where we'll be talking with Joel Lindberg, who is an expert at investment banking and helping companies prepare for the best acquisition process possible. Now, Joel, one of the things that I wanted to talk to you about is your experience at the Singularity University's executive program. Tell me about what that experience was.
Sure. So how do you describe Singularity University? I think somebody once described it as, waterboarding of technology education. This is five pretty intense days, 12 to 14 hours a day, just being bombarded, by the latest and greatest thinking on exponential technologies and innovations going on in a number of different, categories. So, It's really phenomenal. It's almost, I hate to use the word life changing, but it just really does change your perspective on what's possible, what is going to be possible, and how quickly those things are becoming possible.
So give us some examples.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the real takeaway from Singularity University is the idea of exponentials and the way the exponential curves work. Oftentimes, people are programmed to think in a linear fashion. They think things kind of move, they advance at a certain rate per month. And that's what an exponential curve looks like at the start. But what humans aren't programmed to see is how that curve accelerates going into the knees. So when something looks like it's been, sort of advancing at a constant rate, it hits an elbow. And at that point, that technology goes at an exponential rate, a much steeper curve, and advances far faster than anybody thought
was
ever possible.
The hockey stick.
Yeah, the proverbial hockey stick. So when you're thinking about things like, digital medicine, robotics, AI, it seems like we've been waiting for these technologies to happen for, a number of years, but that's because, we're just approaching that point in the curve where these things are going to accelerate at a continuously more rapid point. And at that point, that's where you really see massive technological breakthroughs, the democratization of the technologies and the ability for people to afford these technologies who, perhaps had not been able to in the past.
Are we seeing that in healthcare right now with Cigna and Aetna and Rite Aid and CVS?
Well, to some degree with those companies, but I think, the best example in healthcare is the human genome code. I mean, it used to take a company, millions of dollars and years to do one human genome code. And now you're seeing that sequencing being done for, literally tens of dollars and happening in minutes, if not seconds. So I believe everybody will have their genome sequenced and coded and know exactly what that looks like, within the next 5 to 10 years. And that's a massive change in the way that healthcare is delivered.
And it's going to be delivered essentially from the local drugstore, it looks like.
Yeah, extremely personalized, not only prescriptions, but also sort of treatment regimens. So I think we're going to see a wholesale change in how healthcare is delivered, you know, in this country and really in the world over the course of the next decade.
Well, all right. So tell me a couple of stories about companies that you saw at Singularity University who were experiencing this kind of hockey stick, massive immediate change.
Sure. Well, I mean, the one that everybody will be very familiar with is, you know, I was there in 2013. We were in the prototype Google self-driving car. So this one had the big cameras on it. I mean, it was obviously a car, but you could tell that it had been outfitted to do something different. So we're seeing this driverless car, you know, drive around the parking lot, and we're like, wow, that's pretty cool. I mean, what are we here? 4 years later, these cars are on the road, driving around in our communities. They're being, you know, dispatched all over the world. I mean, that technology has gone from something that was, you know, sort of novel, wow, this car is driving by itself, to something that will be ubiquitous, I think, within the next 2 to 3 years.
All right. So it's a personal experience that you had going to Singularity University because it changed your perception.
Sure.
All right. So after that, what happened after you had this big aha there? How did that carry through for the past, 4 years?
Well, it certainly changed my sort of investment thesis, right? When I evaluate a company now, I look at how they're utilizing these exponential technologies, whether they are, how they are, and who's doing it. And I, you know, when you combine these technologies, that's where you get the greatest return. So when I'm looking at companies, I'm looking, do they recognize how these exponential trends work? Are they working on technologies that are exponential in and of themselves? And if so, are they combining those to drive new and innovative products?
So suppose I'm a business owner, a $20 million business, and I'm thinking, you know, I'm 68, 69, 5 years, 7 years, I'm ready to move the business along to someone else. What should I be looking at, thinking about? What kinds of things can I be bringing together along this line?
Well, you know, one thing that every business has, and I think they don't leverage to their best advantage, is data. And obviously, big data has been sort of a watchword. It's been the hot topic over the past 5, even 10 years, right? But now we're starting to see people be able to leverage this data, use some artificial intelligence, machine learning, to really parse this for very, very valuable insights into their business. Oftentimes, the data is more valuable than the actual business itself, is what we're finding. So I think people need to be very aware of the data they're generating and understand how they can utilize it and leverage it to drive value in their business, because it is a core driver of business valuations going forward.
So I'm a business owner and I say, that sounds exciting and interesting to me, potentially another revenue source. What do I do?
Well, depending on your business, I mean, right, there's a number of ways you can do this. Another thing we...
But should I call somebody? Are there places that say, hey, we're here to monetize your data?
There very well may be, but I think it's probably best to understand what you have before you kind of farm it out to somebody else. What I would recommend is, you know, talking to somebody who's, you know, maybe not a data scientist, but very familiar with these sort of applications, and at least get an understanding of what you have and what that asset is.
Where do I go?
Well, certainly we'd be happy to speak with you about it at Achieve Next. It's not our core competency, but that said, depending on where you're at, we can oftentimes refer or recommend somebody who can help you utilize that to your best advantage.
So if I'm sitting here with a $20 million business and never thought about monetizing my value, my data, giving you a call and talking to you might be helpful.
Oh, absolutely. We spend a lot of time trying to understand a company's IP and assets and, you know, placing a value on those. So that's something we're doing on a day-to-day basis. And whether or not I can value the specific data you have, I can certainly point you in the right direction in terms of what it might be and who you should go to do so.
So can you give me an example? Tell me a story about a company that monetized their data.
I'm working with a really interesting company right now in the food safety. And essentially what they've done is they've created identifying signatures for harmful biologics in food. And they've created a database of these, which, you know, previously did not exist.
Harmful biologics meaning?
Salmonella, E. coli, Listeria, things that can contaminate the food source and potentially make you very sick, possibly kill you. So essentially they created a database of signatures for these different biologics, and there's literally millions of them. And the people who are really interested in this, it turns out they thought it would be sort of commercial food operations, restaurants, people of that nature, which there's a huge market for that. But it's the Department of Defense, the DOD, the government, very, very interested in this database. And they're currently working on a strategic partnership to monetize that database to a significant degree.
All right. Any other ones?
I mean, there's so many examples of this, especially when you get into, when you get into MySpace, which is, you know, digital media, ad tech. I mean, you look at a company like, Maker Studio, recently sold to, Disney, $750 million, very little revenue.
Chump change, right?
Yeah. So that acquisition was done basically for the data, for the view data, on their page views.
Hmm.
Interesting, right? I mean, there's not a lot of revenue to value or justify that valuation, but because they had so much data on what people were clicking on, what people were viewing, how long they were viewing it, results in a $750 million deal.
So I'm thinking now out loud, having been a Sandler trainer for 16 years with Sandler training worldwide, they have a huge number of people that come to their website. I wonder if they have thought about how they could take the data from that and sell it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's not selling names. This is not selling names, right?
Right. I mean, it's selling, it's the underlying behaviors associated with those names, mm-hmm. right? I mean, you can parse the data from the name, separate those things entirely, and still have an incredibly valuable data set, right? Because it's understanding trends, behavior, you know, what's driving people's decision-making process. That's what's really valuable to other companies, and that's where I think you can realize a ton of value from your data.
Well, I know that I created a product and sold it to an internet company back in the 90s, mid-90s. And what they wanted, they literally, what we helped Fox Home Video to actually acquire email addresses. Mm-hmm. And this was, internet was just getting started, right?
Sure.
And so, but the goal was to acquire email addresses. And during the release, the initial release of the X-Men video, my product went out. Little 3-inch CD in that Christmas release of 5 million, and in order to access the wonderful data on that little 3-inch CD, they had to go up on the internet and put in their email address.
Sure.
They got a 23% open rate on that. All right. Now, they were looking to acquire data, but it was specifically email data.
Right.
Personal data. Now, that's not what we're talking about today, though. We're talking about what's even more valuable is, what do those people do? What did they do on the internet? What kinds of, on that massive website that you have, what are they looking at? What are they downloading?
It's that metadata. It's again, behavioral, it's behavioral trends. How are people making decisions? Whether those are buying decisions or browsing decisions, you know, whatever the case may be, there's some underlying behavior that can be deduced from analyzing those data trends. And again, that's just incredibly valuable to almost any business, right?
And any business has a website. And there are companies out there who will take the data from a variety of similar businesses put it together, right?
Sure.
And coordinate and take a look at all of those trends, and that becomes very valuable.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think you're going to see even more of this, going back to Singularity University and exponential technologies, the Internet of Things. I mean, this changes the game in terms of how much data we as a society are producing on a daily, monthly, yearly basis. You know, it used to be measured in gigabytes. It's now measured in terabytes per second. I mean, when you think of the enormity of that amount of information and the ability to parse it and actually leverage it, it's simply mind blowing what the possibilities are. I mean, a team of a few data scientists actually, you know, going through, some actuary tables was able to, you know, better deduce these tables than actuaries have been doing this, you know, practicing it the same way for, you know, over the last 150 years. You know, these guys got a data set, a couple days, had a better table than this insurance company had developed over the whole course of their history.
The traditional was the MetLife actuarial sheet, right?
Right, and, right. And these data science upended that in, you know, a couple of days. Mm-hmm. So it's just incredible to think, you know, what the possibilities are when you can really analyze and leverage these massive amounts of data.
All right, now, are we talking about the business owner, the 65, 70-year-old business owner doing what he does with his iPhone, calling his grandson in to tell him how to use it?
This is, you know, probably a little bit more sophisticated than that. Data scientists are in incredibly high demand right now. You know, going back to that talent conversation, a lot of CFOs are telling us that's what they're hiring for now. It's people who can manipulate these massive data sets, really understand what it looks like, and then explain it to other people. Because, you know, maybe as the 65, 70-year-old executive, you don't have a whole lot of direct experience with data science. But if you can bring in somebody who can, you know, not only do the technical work, but then, you know, put that information into a format that makes sense for you and allows you to make better decisions, you know, that's where you're getting a ton of value from your team.
Well, that's one of the things I'm very interested in. When I talk about helping businesses thrive, I mean, in many cases, California, while we're sometimes described as the nuts and fruit cases of the world, right? at the same time, we're also the place of great creativity. And Orange County, L.A., tremendous generators of creativity.
Sure.
At the same time, there have to be places that are going to challenge traditional businesses and open their imaginations to what does thriving mean in this environment. So are there places? I mean, certainly go to Singularity University, but that's like that's like huge amount of data in front of a fire hose. Well, are there other places where people can come to discover the value that's there in what they already have?
Yeah, absolutely. And just quickly to your point about fruits and nuts, I think California does produce some of the best fruits and nuts in the country. I think people on the East Coast will agree with me there. No, but to your question more directly, yeah, I mean, in California, we've created a culture of innovation, you know, especially obviously, you know, Silicon Valley leading the way in pretty much, you know, every aspect of that. But certainly Silicon Beach here in Los Angeles and Orange County, I mean, thousands of companies doing really, really innovative stuff from a technology standpoint. As I mentioned, you know, a lot of my practice revolves around software as a service, cloud-based technologies, digital medias, and really Southern California is a hub for that. These businesses are creating, you know, tons of actionable intelligence and data, like we were talking about, but also really innovative products that are, you know, changing our lives on a daily basis. So I think we're really in the nexus for innovation from a technological standpoint in California and Southern California in particular. So I think there's a lot of places people can realize, you know, some really interesting visions and ideas and turn those into commercially viable products.
Well, you know, one of the very interesting things with me, with one of my EOS clients, when they begin, this is a manufacturer. They manufacture pumps, right?
Sure.
They have a big a footprint in pool pumps.
Okay.
Right, and then all the way up to pumps for civic water plants. All right, so big manufacturer of pumps. When we looked at their core values, when they began to describe their core values, when we dug out the core values from the company. You know what? This is a manufacturing company. Innovation. That was one of their five core values, was innovation. Now, that's what they had already been doing, but as they began to talk about that in the whole company, then the whole company began to understand what innovation meant and
right.
How that was driving their real value to their customers was the innovation.
I mean, and that's a really old concept, right? Like people talk about innovation like this is something new, that this is something that's developed, you know, in lockstep with technology. That's not the case. I mean, innovation goes back to the wheel, right? I mean,
yeah.
That's the first significant innovation. So, you know, every time somebody improves a process or a system or a way of doing things, that is innovation. I think what's unique about California is we've sort of fostered a culture whereby you're allowed to fail in the pursuit of innovation. And that might be really the core value underlying a lot of our success here, right? People have the ability, and in good companies and strong and innovative companies, they have the ability to fail. Not everything's going to work, right?
Well, where do we learn most? We learn from our failures.
Sure, exactly.
Right? If we are willing to be vulnerable, open and honest, and suggest, or not admit so much as recognize, we tried to do this and it didn't work. Now we can go back and find out what do we need to do different.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
And that's where the real learning comes in.
No question. And again, I mean, it goes back to that idea of institutional knowledge that you talked about. You know, what's our process for failing and learning from that failure and then going on to innovation? I mean, if you can figure that out, you've basically got an evergreen company, right?
Right. Absolutely. Well, Joel, this has been wonderful. I'm so glad that you're with us today. So tell us how a company could get in touch with you if they resonate with any of these ideas. How would they get in touch with you?
Yeah, absolutely. Best way to get in touch with me is through the Achieve Next website. You can find us at achievenext.com. My personal email is joel.lindenberg@achievenext.com. We've got some really great ways to connect in person as well. As you know, I run a CFO roundtable in Orange County quarterly. If you go to the CFOalliance.org, you can find out about our next roundtable, and that'll actually be focusing on technology for CFOs from the CFO perspective. And the other thing I've recently done that I'd love to make people aware of is I put together a CFO special task force where we can convene 25 CFOs and deal professionals to talk through best practices in M&A. So we wrote a special task force report for CFOs by CFOs on the best way to actually execute M&A transactions. And if you're interested in that, you know, please feel free to email me or get in touch with me through the Achieve Next website. Happy to provide you with a copy of the report and figure out how we might be able to help.
So your email address is?
It's joel.lindenberg. That's LINDENBERG at achievenext.com.
Wonderful. Thanks so much for being with us, Joel. This has been really exciting and innovative. A nice conversation. glad to be with you and look forward to working with you on a number of projects.
Hey, thanks so much for having me, Will. Look forward to speaking with you anytime.
So this is the Pilgrim on the 405 asking you to take a look at your processes. Look at your data. Talk to people. There's some gold out there in those data hills. So this is the Pilgrim on the 405 asking you to help your business thrive in California.
You've been listening to the Pilgrim on the 405 with Will Crist. To hear more of the programs in this podcast, go to www.willcrist.com.